It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with a pediatrician about what we know about COVID-19 and kids and some of the difficult decisions parents are facing right now. But first, COVID-19 expresses itself in many different ways. It's a virus that kills some people, while others can be infected and experience no symptoms at all. There are many, many different experiences between those two extremes, and we're hearing more about long-haul COVID patients, people who may never have been sick enough to be hospitalized, but are still experiencing serious and debilitating symptoms months after their initial infection. Nora Berner is one of the outside. The person wore a mask most of the time during your interactions. That seems like something that should have kept you safe.
Yeah, it was early days, you know, it was April, and the mask conversation was still a little bit up in the air at that time. And we thought we were being safe. We never imagined it was going to be anything dangerous. And while without contact tracing and without a lot of information, we don't know exactly how we got sick. This seems to be the best guess right now, because two of my children also had symptoms with the exact same onset as me. And that was really the only time that we were all together with somebody. It was outside. It was pretty surprising.
Right. The kind of thing that many of us might feel comfortable doing, even now, even with all that we know and the mask conversation having moved forward or at least become a lot louder. Nora, on April 17th, tell me what you started feeling, how you got sick.
It was a Friday night, and that's my day off of work, so I'm often sort of tired on that day, and I just felt a little extra tired. And part of my COVID-19 long-haul symptoms are some memory and cognition loss, so this time is a little bit fuzzy in my mind. So I can't really remember exactly why I called the University of Iowa telehealth line, but I called them, and they told me at that time, because I had been exposed to someone with a respiratory illness, that I should go directly to quarantine. It was really nerve-wracking, really scary. And while I was packing up my things really quickly and going to the basement to live for several days, I found myself out of breath going up and down the stairs. And I had never been out of breath before like that in my life. And that's when I realized something was going on.
So I went
into the basement. Yeah.
You took over one of your daughter's bedrooms and tried to remain separate from the rest of the family. They delivered food at the top of the basement stairs. So you would literally crawl up the stairs to get your food. I know that your memory of this time is foggy, but can you tell us what you experienced during those first days after the illness really struck you?
Yeah, so pretty quickly after falling, you know, tired on that first night, even that first night and into that Saturday morning, I was pretty profoundly ill very quickly. I experienced a lot of the symptoms that you hear about. I had a really bad headache. I had eye pain and discomfort. The cough started coming. My shortness of breath increased. And I felt the pressure and heaviness on my chest that I know a lot of us have heard of, but it really felt like I had like a 200-pound person just sitting on my chest. I couldn't get comfortable. It was a really strange sort of time out of time space for me. Because I was in the basement, days sort of ran together, and I didn't know if it was day or night. But as my symptoms grew, my fatigue and my muscle weakness was pretty profound. And like you said, I had to climb up the stairs to get food. Every time I would stand up to go to the bathroom, I had to sort of reground myself and teach myself how to make steps forward. So I went from being really, really healthy in a very short period of time to being a bedridden person.
Did you think that this might kill you?
I did. At the very beginning, that first night when I went into the basement, when I went into quarantine, the thoughts that just ran through my head because they had me move into quarantine so quickly, I really did wonder if I was going to see my kids again, and if I was hugging them. I didn't hug them, obviously, or if I was, you know, I felt sort of like maybe I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. It was very strange that first night. But yeah, in the real depths of the illness, especially when I was in isolation and I was struggling to breathe, I saw the news. I knew the statistics. I was watching my onset progress really rapidly. And I felt like this, if I had gotten a whole lot worse, or I could tell that if things had turned just slightly for me, that you and I wouldn't be having this conversation today.
Did you, I know you had been on the phone and they told you to go into quarantine. Was there a point at which you thought, I've got to get to a doctor or the hospital?
You know, I felt that. I think probably the first time that I had one of the telemedicine visits, when I called in for that conversation to happen, and they said, they made it very clear that I wasn't to come in to the hospital at that time and that they would be following me on telemedicine visits. There was a time, I think it was the following Tuesday after I fell ill on Friday night, that I did call in and say, I'm so sick. And they did a telemedicine visit with me that morning and said, okay, you need to come right in. And I couldn't even walk. I mean, my husband had to help me into the clinic. I was in a wheelchair. That was my first in-clinic experience.
They performed a COVID-19 test on you. And of course, there have been so many things that have happened in the last 3 months. I think it's hard for us to remember what was going on in the middle of April. But tests were pretty scarce in the middle of April. They did give you a COVID-19 test, and that test came back negative. And we know now that there were a lot of false negatives. But getting that test back, you had a nurse tell you that you could be pretty certain that you didn't have COVID. Tell me what happened then.
Yes, yeah, so I'd maintained quarantine. Even as my husband helped me into the clinic that day, you know, I sat in the back seat and we wore masks and tried to stay apart as much as we could. So I was still in quarantine awaiting the results. And yeah, somebody called and told me that very quickly, very abruptly, well, your test came back. It's negative. You don't have COVID. And I asked her, I said, well, how certain are you? And she said 98%, 99%. And I said, well, what is the certainty? And she said, well, that's how accurate the tests are, which we know isn't true now.
Right.
But I asked her what I should do. And she said, well, you can just go be with your family. And it felt so wrong to me. I took about 30 minutes or an hour staying in the basement, just, I called my husband on FaceTime and it's like, what should we do? And all we could do at that point was use the very certain information we'd received from the nurse who called us. And I reluctantly came out of quarantine. But then my next telemedicine visit with someone, because I was still profoundly ill, they informed me that I did have COVID, even though they were considering me to having a clinical diagnosis of COVID versus the test. And that was a hard day. That was a hard day when we realized that I had come out of quarantine prematurely.
Right. And exposed your family, although they had already been exposed initially, you exposed your family to this disease.
Yeah. And we didn't know that at the time. We hadn't sort of pieced together the fact that they had all been exposed already. It was a really hard day for me, yeah, thinking that I had put them in danger.
I can't imagine. So did you, I mean, obviously this illness went on, it's still going on. In those first few weeks, did you get medical care? Was there any kind of medicine or therapy or really anything that anybody could do for you?
Absolutely nothing. I just had to ride it out. I mean, I received a lot of they watched me very closely. You know, I had a telemedicine call every 2 days, if not every day. I had several medical professionals following up with me, but it was just a watch and wait situation. The only sort of change that I made in any kind of medication was for the profound headaches and pain. You can only take Tylenol and not ibuprofen. So I took Tylenol. That was it.
Did it help?
I did not have a helpful experience with the Tylenol. I understand that for safety reasons, that's the recommendation, but it really did not cut down my pain in any way. I think maybe it helped a little tiny bit with my eye pain, because I really couldn't, you know, watch shows or even be on my iPhone to pass the time, because my eyes hurt so bad. But yeah, the Tylenol didn't really help.
Well, Nora, we are going to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk more about your experiences in just a moment. I'm talking with Nora Berner. She is a long-haul COVID-19 survivor and patient. She continues to deal with symptoms of COVID-19, even though she came down with the disease back in April, on April 17th. She is a mother of four who lives in Iowa City. She works for an Episcopal church and is also a seminary student. And we'll talk more about her experiences in a moment. If you are a long-haul COVID patient, you're welcome to share your experiences with us as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with a pediatrician about what we know about COVID-19 and kids. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Nora Berner. She is a long-haul COVID-19 patient. She first got sick on April 17th, and now, more than 3 months later, she is still regularly dealing with symptoms that become powerful enough to be debilitating. She's 40 years old. She had no pre-existing conditions that would have made her vulnerable to this disease, but still, 3 months on, she is struggling. She's a mother of four who lives in Iowa City. And Nora, just before the break, we were talking about those early weeks where you were bedridden, you'd had a negative COVID test, but they said that probably doesn't mean that you don't have COVID. They continued it or considered it to be a clinical diagnosis of COVID-19. Now, as the weeks went on and you didn't get better, what kind of medical care did you receive?
I had a number of different pieces of medical care. So I was in the ILI clinic, which is the respiratory infectious disease or influenza-like illness clinic at the University of Iowa, which meant I had video visits with them. And at a certain point, you know, because there's not a lot that's known about this disease, I was transferred to internal medicine, back to my primary care doctor, just because there's nothing more that they could do for me. You know, it's really built up as a triage clinic to help people through those early days. And to be honest, we're still trying to figure out the best course of action for me. Over the weekend, I was transferred back to another clinic. They're trying to figure out different referrals for me right now. But really, this space of being a long hauler, it's medically a brand new thing, and nobody really knows what to do with it.
You mentioned earlier that some of your kids had symptoms. You have four children, and two of your kids developed something called COVID toe. What is COVID toe?
Yeah, COVID toe is a type of dermatological rash that appears on the extremities, primarily on the toes. They're seeing it more in teenagers and young adults, and sometimes in people who've been very ill in the hospital with COVID at the end of their illness. They're still studying it, obviously, like everything else with COVID. But my two teenagers had small chilblains or blood blisters on their toes. My eldest just had one on her big toe, but my second oldest had a lot of different complex rashes on her feet and developed some circulation issues, even up into her legs. And But we didn't figure that out for a little bit because I was really sick, so they didn't mention it to me.
Yeah, I can imagine thinking, I have a sore foot. I don't need to bother my mom with this right now. Are they okay now?
Yeah, they're doing really well. The one who'd had the worst case of it still hasn't been cleared by dermatology yet. She's still doing, you know, daily washes and topical treatments on it, but it's pretty much gone. So we're hopeful she'll be discharged very soon.
You have four kids, so that leaves two others and your husband. They were all clearly exposed to COVID-19 because you came out of quarantine for a period and you were so very sick. Had they had any symptoms at all?
My middle schooler had an upset stomach for a tiny bit of time, and the onset was similar, and all the three older kids all were followed up with telemedicine visits. But my husband and my three-year-old had nothing, not a sniffle, not a sore throat, nothing.
Did your kids ever get tested for COVID-19?
They didn't. It was early days. It was hard for me to even get that one test for me, as profoundly ill as I was. We've been told that they would like, if the antibody tests ever get a little bit better, or there's more concrete evidence for how they're working, that they would like to test them for antibodies in the future.
So I guess we can't know, but it sounds like at least three cases of COVID-19 in your family are probably not counted among the numbers that we know about in the state of Iowa.
True.
That raises a lot of questions about how this disease has traveled through our population. So I want to talk to you, Nora, about now. Again, it's been more than 90 days, more than 3 months that you've been sick. And you have had some good days, but tell me what it's like. Can you give me an idea of this roller coaster you've been on?
Yeah, roller coaster is the perfect word. There isn't a lot of rhyme or reason or pattern to it. When I wake up in the morning, I don't know if it's going to be a good day or a kind of good day or a really hard day for me. And hard days right now for me involve neurological issues. I had neurological issues onset 10 days into my illness, including numbness of fingers and toes, and my taste altered at that point. My taste was gone for several days, but now I have just metallic taste in my mouth. And what I've realized in the last couple of weeks here is if I have a more metallic taste in my mouth, that's generally an indicator to me if it's going to be a tougher day. So I have the neurological symptoms. I'm having some cardiovascular issues. So my heart rate is very irregular. I've had Holter monitors and EKGs. They've ruled out any heart damage, which is really good news. But my heart rate will be up in the 150s and then just drop down to 42. But I would say the thing that I'm dealing with the most is probably the fatigue and the brain fog, and then the breathing issues. I didn't have a ton of breathing issues at the beginning of my illness, but I did develop a secondary infection. And ever since then, have really been struggling to get my breathing under control. So I have three different breathing medications, actually four that I have, and I have to take them about every 4 hours, and it's tough to manage.
What do you mean by breathing medications? Can you tell me what kinds of treatments you're getting?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So right now I do a inhaled steroid medication that's an inhaler that helps with the inflammation, because we now know that COVID is a vascular disease or a vascular virus, that it affects the vascular system. And one of the things they're noting is in some of these long haul patients, myself included, is inflammation in the lungs, prolonged inflammation. So I take a steroid inhaler to help with the inflammation in my lungs. And then I take a sort of rescue nebulizer to help with some of the closing of my airways, to help open my airways. I do that with a machine. And then I've most recently begun taking a pill that is designed to help support my breathing. And I take that at night because the steroid medication was keeping me up at night, and sleep is hard for me to get anyways. So I did not need something else keeping me up at night, that's for sure.
And that, coupled with the extreme fatigue that you've been experiencing, I'm sure has been incredibly frustrating. I'm talking with Nora Berner. She is a long-haul COVID-19 patient who lives in Iowa City, again, 40 years old, no pre-existing conditions that made her vulnerable to this disease. She came down with it on April 17th and is still struggling with symptoms. I want to talk a little bit about the neurological issues that you mentioned, some numbness in your hands and your feet, or neuropathy. Can you, thinking about your hands, how serious is this? Does it impair your fine motor skills?
Yes. This is something that's only developed in the last probably 2 weeks here, that I'm having trouble typing. And on good days, I can type some, you know, but even simple things like texting my daughter to let her know to bring the dog in or something like that, I couldn't do it. So yeah, it's really odd. It's sort of like it makes my hands not stiff, but that I can't control them as I wish I could.
And does that come and go?
It seems to come and go. I seem to be in a period where it's more profound right now. But I have to keep reminding myself, as with everything I've experienced with COVID, it is this roller coaster, and I just have to hold fast that this will pass as well. I just don't know how long this season of my hands being this tingly will be.
And no one really knows how long these kinds of symptoms can last. As I mentioned earlier, we're hearing about more patients like you who are dealing with what some people are calling the long tail of COVID-19. Have you connected with other people who are having similar experiences?
Yeah, I've connected with a few people. I've decided to share my story pretty broadly, obviously here today, but also through social media and through social media and making some public posts. I've been connected with people all over the country, or people who've just written to me privately and say, oh, this is my story, or my sister has that same story. And I'm a part of a couple of support groups as well, where people are cataloging and saying their experiences. And everybody seems to be having a very similar experience to me. Some people are experiencing gaslighting of their symptoms. I do experience that a little bit, where I sort of feel like I have to fight for, no, this is real. This is really happening to me. But that's been really comforting for me to connect with other people, because this can be a very isolating experience, quarantine aside.
Well, and as you're indicating, I mean, there are a lot of people in this country who still don't believe that COVID-19 is real. There are many people who are refusing to wear masks in public, and this has been very politicized. There's a lot of news that I can imagine can be really, really upsetting, especially to someone like you who's had this personal experience. How do you cope with that?
I cope in a number of different ways. I try to, as everybody else, I try not to digest too much news. If it's starting to bother me, I just need to turn it off. But ultimately, what I have to do is I have to sort of take this quiet time to myself, and or talk with my husband or somebody else or good friends, and just say, this is real, right? Like, what's happening to me is really happening. And everyone's like, yes, this is real. But the other way that I've coped is, as I've already said, I'm sharing my story. It's become really important to me to name this as a truth. And this isn't, I'm not sharing my story to get sympathy or to get attention. I'm sharing my story to tell people that this is real, and that I'm a real person without any previous symptoms who is experiencing this. And this is my day-to-day life. And the other side of this is I've had amazing medical care. I'm an educated person. I can advocate for myself. And there are so many people in our country who have the same story as me, who've not had adequate medical care, who are even more isolated, who don't have enough money to get the medicine they need. So it's so important for me to share my story, to highlight them.
This has been such an incredibly trying experience, and it's not over. You just last week had a fever spike that put you in bed for 24 hours where you were flat on your back again. You have four kids. I can only imagine that before you got sick, you were an extremely active and engaged mother. And this must be so frustrating to not be able to do some of the things that you really need to do, want to do, love to do. How are you coping with that part of the illness?
That might be the hardest part, actually, because, you know, I can handle my own physical symptoms and work through that. But at some point, in one of my darkest days, where I was really struggling to breathe, I had this kind of spiritual experience where I realized that I could either sort of panic my way and fight, or I could just let go and realize what I can control about this and what I can't control. And once I did that, and once I continue, I have to keep reminding myself of that. That has helped me with some of that frustration. And I know every parent says that their kids are amazing, but I really have the best kids. My three oldest, my junior high school kids, they have just stepped up in the most beautiful, amazing ways. They each take 3 hours every day with my three-year-old. My 12-year-old has developed a love of baking and cooking. They walk the dogs. They are just amazing. My husband has been so supportive. He cooks dinner every night. My family has just filled in all of the gaps where I am unable to now. And as frustrating as that is, it has really helped me find a new appreciation for the beauty of our family and how amazing they are.
We just have a little over a minute left. And I know you said you're speaking this story so that people understand the truth of COVID-19. But what do you want the people who are listening to you right now to take away from your story?
I want people to take away from my story that, yes, that this is real, but if you forget your mask, if you run to the store quickly, try to remember me, try to remember my story, and go back and put your mask on. I would love it if we had that 100% mask compliance here in Iowa. Just if I could prevent even one person from getting sick with my story, then that's beyond worth it. Social distancing and masks are so key. And if I had known that, I wouldn't have gotten sick. We wouldn't have gone on that social occasion, or I would have worn a mask. So there are things you can do to prevent it and keep everybody safe.
With school starting in August, a lot of parents have questions. That's what we're going to be talking about in just a moment. What would you say to other parents?
Everybody has to make the best decision for themselves. But that I think we all need to take this seriously. And I know you're tired because I'm tired too. I know we're all tired of being isolated and this is so hard. I think everyone has to make the best decision for themselves. My family, it's too risky for me. My kids will not be going back. We're going to choose the online option. It's just a reality of my family. And I would hope that people who have that capacity could be online so that people who don't have that choice are able to send their kids to school in a safe way to have more space in the building.
Nora Berner, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Charity. It's been a pleasure.
Nora Berner is a mother of four who lives in Iowa City. She works for an Episcopal church and is a seminary student. She got sick on April 17th and is still dealing with the symptoms of COVID-19. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with pediatrician Dr. Amy Shriver about what we know about kids and COVID-19. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Since schools closed in March, children in Iowa have largely been shielded from exposure to COVID-19. But the school year begins in just a few weeks. School districts are still working on their plans. Many of them have been thrown into disarray by Governor Reynolds' July 17th proclamation. But it seems certain that many children in Iowa will be physically back in school along with teachers and staff. I've asked Dr. Amy Shriver, a pediatrician with Unity Point Health in Des Moines, to help us understand what we do and do not know about COVID-19 and kids. Hello, Dr. Shriver.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me today.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I'm curious, you, of course, take care of kids all the time. This summer, when somebody has called your office and said, I think my child might have COVID-19 symptoms, how do you respond?
Well, we can respond in different ways. So, if a child is very young, we want to see that child and do an exam and test the child and then provide continued support for the child if they test positive or even if they're symptomatic with something else. If the child is otherwise doing okay, if they're an older child, if they don't have some special healthcare needs, and they're having fevers and coughs, but they're able to eat and drink, and they're otherwise doing okay, then we recommend that those kids stay home and do the isolation for the recommended 10 days. And they don't always even need to be tested. So we're providing a lot of support, and we want to continue to encourage parents that have concerns to call their doctor's office and then also to continue doing regular well-child visits and vaccinations.
We are starting to hear more news from around the world. There was just a study released from South Korea that shows that children who are over the age of 10 seem to be much more likely to, if they have COVID-19, to pass it on to others than younger children. But, you know, talking to Nora a few minutes ago, she had three children who probably had symptoms of COVID-19 and never received a test. I've interviewed a number of people over the last few months who had COVID-19 and their children were assumed to have it and never tested. And I'm curious, I mean, do we have much data on children and COVID-19 in this country?
Well, the data continues to accumulate, and we're kind of running with the data that we have right now. So this is a new virus for us, so we are collecting the data that's been from different countries across the world as the pandemic has swept globally. So, you mentioned that the South Korea study that was just came into the news today about kids that are under age 9 and kids who are 10 and up, and how much do these kids transmit the virus and how susceptible are they? So I think that is that's a question that's on a lot of parents' minds when I talk to them in my clinic or even just my neighbors and friends on social media. So this is what we know about kids in general. We do know that, or we believe from the data that we have now, that children tend to be infected less frequently than adults. And, again, the age ranges we're still looking at those, but that we know that children are less likely to get infected than adults. And we know that most children who are infected tend to have a milder form of the disease, and that that children aren't as much of a vector or the cause of transmission to other people as we once thought. So I think that's really an important finding to talk about when we think about kids going to school. So there was an article released in Pediatrics at the beginning of July that looked back on a few different studies across the country. So we know that one Swiss study that happened between March and April had 40 hospitalized children with COVID, and they did some contact tracing, so trying to find the index case or who gave them their COVID. And in those 40 kids, only 3 of them was a child the reason for getting COVID, and the rest of them got COVID from an adult. And the same goes for a study in China that was from January to February, where 68 hospitalized children, in those 68 children, only 3 were children the index case or the cause that those hospitalized children got COVID. So I think we're seeing that it seems like children aren't getting this from other children. They're getting it from adults, and it's actually more likely to get it somewhere inside your own household than it would be to get it other places. So I think that's a little bit of hope for families as we start this journey back to school. We have also seen a couple of examples of kids in schools. And so in France, there was a 9-year-old boy who exposed 80 of his classmates to COVID, and none of those 80 kids got infected. So that's some reason to kind of say, well, maybe we won't see as much infection spreading as we worry about. And then in Australia, there was a group of 9 students and 9 staff that were infected, and they kind of covered the distance of about 15 schools. And they exposed about 735 students and 128 staff. And of all of those exposures, only 2 infections happened. One was a student that got infected by a staff member, and then the other was a high school student infected by high school classmates. So overall, again, we don't have all the data. We can't truly predict what's going to happen, but it looks so far like the data is trending toward younger kids having less likely transmission and going to get maybe less severe symptoms if they do get it.
With the school year beginning soon, do you think that the way that we might respond to a child with symptoms will change? Will we do more testing of kids and young people?
Well, I think schools haven't completely decided how they're going to ask kids to get tested and how we're going to have kids return to school after infection. So I think that's a question that many of us still have out there, is what do we do if someone in our class gets exposed, and what does an exposure really mean? So I think we're going to have to stay tuned to see what those recommendations are and how we best respond. As of right now, what I would recommend is if you have symptoms, that you stay home for the recommended 10 days, and then to make sure that you've been fever-free for at least 24 hours without any Tylenol or ibuprofen on board. So that's going to be the recommendation from many pediatricians, is that you still isolate at home until your symptoms go away. And I think that's a really important message for all of us, is that I think a lot of us live in a state of denial. We don't really want to have symptoms. And so a lot of people are pretending they don't have symptoms and still trying to go about their normal day, maybe as you would do if you had the common cold. And that's a really important public health message, is that we can't be doing that now. We can't pretend we don't have symptoms. If we think we have symptoms that are dry cough, sore throat, fever, we need to stay home, and we need to protect our friends, family, and teachers.
The American Academy of Pediatrics has waded into the discussion over opening schools, physical face-to-face education, and of course there was an announcement, there was a bit of a walk back on the announcement. Tell us where the American Academy of Pediatrics stands right now on the return to learn.
So, yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics recently published updated guidance for school reopening, and we are encouraging the goal of having students in school under the framework of careful measures to keep children, staff, and teachers safe. So that means that we need to look within our communities and base our decisions on community COVID prevalence. So there will probably be areas of the country where it's not safe to return to school. So it depends on how much COVID we're seeing in the community. So rather than kind of a walk back, the AAP wanted to clarify that it wasn't a sweeping statement that everybody everywhere should go back to school full time, but that it needs to be carefully tailored to the context of your community and also the context of your individual student needs. So the other really important statement that's come out from the American Academy of Pediatrics is that schools really need extra funding to make this safe for their teachers, their staff, and their students. So we can't just continue with business as usual at schools. schools were already underfunded and teachers underpaid. So this is a really important time for us to really call for increased funding for schools to help our children, staff, and teachers be safe. You may have heard that there was a governor's press conference, and the Iowa AAP immediate past president spoke there. We feel fortunate that we're able to have our voice heard in the state. We, however, would say that we did not have any involvement with the state's reopening plans. We're simply restating what our national organization says about the fact that many, many students really rely on in-person school for overall health. And that includes their social and emotional health and their physical health, as well as some other needs. So some children out there have special education needs that really aren't as well served with virtual learning. Some children get therapies at school, like speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, or even mental health therapy that they can't get other places at this time. There are a lot of children who rely on schools for adequate nutritional support. So for our food insecure families, schools can be a really important provider. And then right now, what we're seeing in our clinics is a trend of really sedentary kids who aren't getting enough exercise. So we know that schools are a place where kids tend to get regular physical activity and exercise, which is important for their long-term health. Schools are also a place where teachers have eyeballs on children, so we can monitor for signs of mental health concerns and physical abuse concerns. So schools tend to play a lot more roles than just what we think about, which is, you know, our standard learning. So the AAP really supports all of those reasons why we want to have some options for in-person learning.
Well, it sounds like you want to emphasize the dangers of not returning to school, but there are dangers of returning to school as well. And we don't have a lot of time, but we have Lindsay's on the line from Cedar Rapids, and she would love for you to talk a little bit about the proper safety measures for kids to go back to school. We could spend an hour and a half talking about that at least. But Dr. Shriver, from your perspective, can we protect our kids in school, and what measures do you think would work?
Well, I think it's important to note that we cannot be able to completely prevent the transmission. This isn't a 100% guarantee of safety, but nothing is ever 100% guaranteed. And we know that kids go to school and, you know, they come back from school with strep and influenza and other things. So we know that there's always a risk with that, but it is very important that we take appropriate protection measures for the kids themselves, as well as for the adults in the school who are probably at an increased risk compared with the kids. So that means appropriate cloth face coverings for kids. And I do advocate for that in all kids who are able to do that. And I have been getting a lot of questions. So number one, are masks, you know, bad for your health? And the answer is no, masks are not bad for your health. You don't have problems with increased carbon dioxide breathing in. You shouldn't have any health problems related to mask wearing in general. And then I have had other families ask, are masks bad for children's mental health? And the answer is no, there's no evidence to support that masks are bad for children's mental health. And in fact, the overall benefits of seeing their friends at school would certainly outweigh the, you know, any concerns about not being able to see a nose or a mouth. So just some reassurance there that masks are effective at helping to prevent or mitigate some of the spread of COVID, and that they're really important. And so we're recommending it for all kids who are able to do that. Everyone under age 2, you don't have to wear a mask, but over age 2, I do think it's something to consider, and definitely in our older kids.
And it sounds like you have a lot of faith that kids can learn to wear masks. I mean, it took my kids a while to learn to wear pants, but they did that. So you feel like kids can get used to this?
I do think so. I think that kids are smarter than our parents give them credit for a lot of times, and that if parents are great role models and say, hey, this is important, we love our neighbors, we love our teachers, we want to keep our friends and our teachers safe, so we should definitely wear masks. If the family has that messaging to kids and kids see their friends wearing masks, it shouldn't be as hard as we fear getting kids to wear masks. I see kids come into my clinic every day. We require masks in our clinics, and they do a great job with it. It does take some practice, so I would encourage families to, you know, get on board with getting masks early and having them practice wearing them, and definitely wearing them in the community if they venture out at this point. But I'm sending my kids to school, and they're definitely on board with wearing masks. So try to make it fun. Try to get them to get their favorite, you know, cartoon characters or literature characters on their mask to make it more fun. But yes, I think kids can do this as long as parents encourage it.
Sending one's kids back to school is going to be a really difficult decision for a lot of families. And I know a lot of teachers and staff members are extremely worried about their own safety. This is a really emotional and difficult time. And one of my greatest hopes is that maybe we can not politicize this from family to family and not judge each other harshly. But as parents are making this decision, I mean, Amy, you've made your decision, but do you have any wisdom just very briefly to share with parents as they mull this over?
Well, I agree that there's so much anxiety about this. I mean, from what I've seen on my Facebook groups and what I've seen in my clinic, parents are very anxious, and I don't blame them. I'm anxious too, because I don't think we really truly know what's going to happen. So I can't predict it any more than anyone else can predict it. I can give parents a little bit of hope in that I think with proper mask wearing and proper hand sanitizing, we can make a difference and decrease the spread. And I think that also the important message of communities chipping in. If everybody wears masks, then there's increased hope that in the future we can maybe bring prom back and bring homecoming back and bring graduation back for our kids. So I think that there's a little bit of hope out there just in terms of how we can reduce the spread. But I do understand people's anxiety, and I hope that families who are able to and who want to can do that virtual option. So I do support families who think that's necessary and who really want to do that.
Dr. Amy Shriver, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much, Charity. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Amy Shriver, a pediatrician with Unity Point Health in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.